It's high noon, and time to feed your mind on the Brown Bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Should the Bush administration be charged with war crimes in Iraq? Why did the Americans ship arms to both the Sunnis and the Shias? These questions and more as famous CBC broadcaster Hal Wake interrogates Barry Lando, author of Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, From Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. This was part of a fascinating Talk of the Town series sponsored by the UBC Office of Community Affairs. It happened before a standing room only audience at the UBC Robson Media Center on February 2, 2007. Let's tune in to the debate.
Tonight it's Barry Lando. The history of the West intervention in Iraq did not begin with the U.S. invasion in 2003. From its very creation at the end of World War I, the West has been involved in everything from the coups that brought Saddam to power, to the devastating war with Iran, to the use of chemical weapons against the Kurds. Journalist and author Barry Lando has traced the history of complicity from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush, and he joins us this evening. Please welcome Barry Lando. This book, your book, was written before the trial of Saddam Hussein, and yet, in a way, it's almost a counterpoint to the trial. And you use the trial that hadn't happened as an element in the book. Why did you connect the history of Iraq to a trial that had not yet taken place?
Well, I guess it began when Saddam was captured alive. I thought at the time there'd be a lot of people in Washington, a lot of former and present leaders in Washington and other capitals of the world who'd be very worried. They probably would have preferred that he either committed suicide or was killed at the time, because there, a lot of these people were complicit in the crimes for which he was going to be tried. And so I started basically to write this book about the, as it became evident that these people were not going to be put on trial, in a way to sort of describe what that trial could have been.
Well, that's exactly the right answer, because, in fact, I've structured...
Good.
I've structured this conversation as a trial, and I will be bringing the charges that I think you lay and asking you to make the case to back up the charges that you have against the West. But just before we begin the trial, now that three people have been executed as a result of that process, so the book was written before the trial, two trials now over, with Saddam and two others executed. What's your view of those proceedings?
Well, they were sort of part and parcel of the, of the idea was to protect, in a way, the people who were complicit in these crimes, particularly the American leaders, but others as well, from becoming involved publicly in the trial. In other words, the tribunal was set up by the Americans. It's financed by the Americans. The judges have been trained by the Americans. The lawyers have all been trained by the Americans. The Americans are even doing most of the investigation for the trial. But the statute, one of the statutes of the trial, which no one in the media really has picked up on, says that only Iraqi citizens or residents can be charged.
So that immediately...
Well, that leaves out a lot of people.
And it also means that if you're tailoring the charges specifically, and God knows you could choose a lot to charge Saddam with, but you can choose ones where you don't have to bring in evidence against other of the
exactly.
complicit partners.
Exactly, right.
Okay, so let's go to charge number one. And I don't know whether you see them in any kind of hierarchy. I've tried to choose them in order of the things that seem to be most serious to me. And maybe we can talk about that later. But so the first charge that I'm going to put to you that you've raised is that the UN sanctions resulted in deaths of 500,000, I think, to 1 million Iraqis between 1990 and 2003. How do you arrive at that number?
Well, I didn't arrive at it. The United Nations arrived at it. I think it was a UNESCO figure, an estimate, because no one was keeping count. But there are other studies that have said it might have been 400,000. Another one says 600,000. But as it is today, I mean, no one is around there counting the dead bodies. And in Iraq at the time, the sanctions, in a way, may have killed more people than Saddam Hussein did. And they were Saddam Hussein was not involved in those at all. In other words, he was a target of them. But that was a crime, and I call it a crime, that was committed basically by the United States and England. They were the prime countries that were directing the sanctions and making sure that they maintained, they kept tight control over everything entering Iraq.
Yeah, but they exempted humanitarian aid. So, well, I mean, they on the books, they said that humanitarian aid would be allowed, and yet you write that baby food didn't make it under the embargo, chlorine didn't make it under the embargo.
Baby food, they ruled that baby food could be consumed by adults as well, and so they blocked baby food going in. Even medical journals were not allowed to be imported into Iraq.
And the danger precisely from medical journals?
No foreign literature could come into the country. The idea was to make life so unbearable for the Iraqi people, kill enough of their children so that they would rise up and overthrow Saddam Hussein. Now, this wasn't my theory. This was told to me by the former director of humanitarian aid for the United Nations in Iraq, who quit because he refused to administer that problem. He termed it genocide.
So nothing was getting in? Nothing in terms aid that could have alleviated the problem?
No. Not only that, is the United States set up the problem too, because they bombed in the preparation for the first Gulf War. They destroyed a lot of the sewage treatment facilities, the water treatment facilities, the electrical plants in and around Baghdad, so that they wiped out the infrastructure. At the time, the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency of the Pentagon, made a study as to how complete the devastation was and what would happen if these systems were not repaired. And they predicted that there would be widespread gastroenteritis, diseases, cholera, and they were absolutely right. But they made sure that Iraq could not import the parts that were needed to repair the system. So what you had over the next few months and years, you had hundreds of thousands of children coming down with serious diseases. They'd be taken to the hospitals, and in the hospitals, it was impossible to treat them. They didn't have the medicines. They didn't have the equipment necessary to treat them. And so often people just stopped going to the hospitals. They took their children home to die.
Well, let's talk then about another measure that the UN took to ensure that some kind of economic revival, or at least economic activity, was going to happen in Iraq. And in 1996, the UN passed Resolution 986, and apparently that allowed Iraq to sell oil. It did stipulate that 30% of the revenue had to go to the UN and Kuwait, but aside from that, presumably, the rest was going to help Iraq feed itself. Wasn't that an attempt to fix the situation?
It was a fig leaf. And this, again, is not my term. This was the expression used by the second administrator for the program, who quit in protest against having to run this program for the United Nations. If you divided the amount that Iraq generated by selling that petroleum, the amount of money, it worked out to something like 30 cents per Iraqi per day, or even less than that. And it wasn't just for food. This was to cover all imports for the country. So it was a pitiful amount, and it didn't meet the needs of the country.
And one would presume that much of that money never made it to the people anyway, having to go through the administration as
right. And there's no question that Saddam ripped off money as well, and that there was smuggling of petroleum going on at the time. But the United States knew about that at the time. They knew that smuggling was going on. They knew that hundreds of millions of dollars of petroleum, Iraqi petroleum, were going out through Jordan and Syria. But they let it happen because these were their allies at the time. So for the United States later on to claim, well, it's Saddam's fault what happened during the embargo, the smuggling, the corruption, they knew about it all along.
What would have happened had there been no sanctions? Because you can't... we can't honestly believe that Saddam would have turned around and become a benevolent dictator and dedicated himself to the rebuilding of the country and ensuring that every Iraqi had a roof over their head and decent medical care.
No.
With no sanctions that way. Right. So what would have happened without
sanctions?
Well,
the thing is that the sanctions were, it was a useless policy, and the idea was to get the Iraqis to rise up. But early on, they realized the Iraqis weren't going to rise up because Saddam was much too brutal a tyrant. Anybody who raised his head got it lopped off. So, and the U.S. realized this early on, but they had no other policy. And the man who told me that was a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Thomas Pickering. He admitted they had no other policy, so they just continued this policy. And this was not just the Republicans, it was Bill Clinton for 8 years as well. And it was Bill Clinton's ambassador to the United Nations, Madeleine Albright, who was asked...
Very directly.
She was asked on 60 Minutes. It was one of the few good programs done in the U.S. on the sanctions. It was around 1996. She was asked by Leslie Stahl, look, these sanctions have killed hundreds of thousands of children... Probably more children than Hiroshima, and in the end, was it worth it? And Madeleine Albright said, yes, we feel it was worth it. And in her autobiography, she said immediately after she said that, she regretted having said it.
But she said it.
But she said it. And when I put that to an Iraqi who was very bitter about the U.S. actions, when I put that to... An Iraqi who was very bitter about U.S. actions, he said, oh, yes, she regretted having said it.
Yes.
That's it.
But not necessarily the policies.
Right.
Okay, this is the last question on charge number one. Do you think that a credible case could be made against the United States and Great Britain that they broke Geneva Convention? Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the Geneva Conventions, cutting off food to a civilian population is a war crime. And I list them in the book, but there are four or five articles of the Geneva Conventions that are... and again, the one who made the strongest argument about this were the former UN administrators of that program.
And I don't suppose that is going to happen.
Oh, don't hold your breath.
All right, charge number two.
But you see, what's interesting is that... That's not even a crime that involves Saddam Hussein. That's not one of the crimes. That's a crime that is specifically a crime of the West.
Is there any process for that being adjudicated?
Sure, it could be. I mean, it's a crime. Lawyers have told me that people could bring charges against Bill Clinton or whoever for having committed this breach of the Geneva Conventions.
But as you said, don't hold your breath.
Yeah.
Saddam Hussein was accused of murdering hundreds of thousands of Shiites and Shiite Iraqis and Kurds after the uprising. And you say, and I quote, the U.S. government and its allies by actions, inactions, were actually complicit in massacres. The U.S. not only incited and then abandoned the rebellion, it actually enabled brutal repression. How did they incite that?
Well, this was as Saddam was being chased out of Kuwait in 1991 by the U.S. and the coalition. And George Bush Sr. at that time called for a popular uprising. He made a speech in the United States on two occasions, and that speech was relayed throughout Iraq by the CIA, secret radio transmitters, and then U.S. Air Force planes dropped millions of pamphlets over Iraq with that same message from George Bush Sr. And so the Iraqis rose up, the Shiites in the south. I mean, they were doing it in the wake of the defeat of Saddam. They rose up in the south, and then the Kurds rose up in the north, and some units of Saddam's army, the defeated units, started to go over to the side of the rebels. And I forget the figure, I think it's something like 14 out of 22 of the major population centers in Iraq became in the hands of the rebels. And even Saddam himself felt that his day was over.
He thought that they would be sweeping into Baghdad and taking... Yeah.
But what happened was that all of a sudden George Bush Sr. and James Baker looking at this, the chaos, became afraid. In other words, that it could, they were afraid that Iran would take advantage of it, increase its influence, that the Kurds would break off, and that would get the Turks upset. And
Well, yes, they would. They looked at a scenario where in the north there would be battles between the Kurds and the Turks, or at least
The Turks didn't want an independent Kurdish territory because they had their own Kurds.
Problems in the south with the Iran supporting the Iraqi Shiites and the potential for a total breakup. Wasn't that a realistic fear?
Well, it was a realistic fear, except that the Iranians were not as active in the south as they thought they were. And we could get, if you wanted, we can talk about that after. If we finish this part first, so Bush turned his back on the uprising, and he ordered all American troops who were just a few kilometers away from where the uprising was taking place, who could actually see the villages, etc. He ordered them to do nothing to aid the uprising. Meanwhile, they permitted Saddam's battle helicopters to strafe and bomb the rebel villages.
Tommy Franks actually gave permission for those helicopters to fly, didn't he?
Yeah, Schwarzkopf was at the end.
The
Iraqis at the end, when they made peace at the end of the battle, the first Gulf War, the Iraqis said, can we at least use our helicopters to transport our people because our transport, the bridges are out and the roads are in bad repair. So the U.S. said, okay. But it wasn't the idea that you could use them to go to war against your own people. But even though they suddenly did, the U.S. refused to stop it, and they could have. At the same time, American soldiers were not only told not to aid the rebels in any way, but when rebels came to their lines, they asked the Americans, you don't have to come and fight for us, just give us weapons. Because the U.S. had huge stocks of captured weapons that they'd taken from the defeated Iraqi army. Instead of giving them the weapons, American soldiers destroyed them. And I had them, this was told to me by a special forces officer who was on the front lines, who felt absolutely, he still, years afterwards, he was still heartstricken at what he had done, having to turn his back on these rebels. So they destroyed all the weapons rather than giving it to them. And at the same time, when the rebel leaders tried to reach, to talk to the Americans, American generals and American politicians in Washington, Kurds and Shiites, the Americans refused to meet with them. So on one hand, Bush and Baker are worried about who these people might be and what direction the uprising is going to take, but at the same time, they refuse to meet with the leaders of the uprisings.
So they've dropped the leaflets, they've encouraged some kind of uprising,
right,
led those people to assume that there would be support from the Allies,
right,
and received none.
Right.
But one of the issues that...
And then what finally happened in the wake of that, when the uprising was defeated, Saddam's forces came and slaughtered, and it could have been 100,000, 150,000 of them, the Americans knew it was going on. They were observing it.
But weren't the Americans in something of an untenable situation, in that that particular war had been put together and waged with the support of Arab allies, which was a fairly tenuous kind of coalition of forces? And those allies wouldn't have tolerated American action to do anything other than drive Iraq out of Kuwait. Isn't that true?
Well, that's what the U.S. said afterwards. But in fact, the Saudis, who were supposedly the ones who didn't want the Americans to support the uprising, the Saudis at one point proposed to the Americans that they secretly help the uprising, the Shiite uprising. It was the Americans who refused to do it.
This is CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, Vancouver, and you are listening to broadcaster Hal Wake interview Barry Lando, author of Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush.
You make an interesting point, and I hope you can elaborate on it here. There are some people who believe that betrayal, if you want to call it a betrayal, of people against Saddam in 1991 actually influenced how Iraqis reacted to the American invasion in 2003.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Americans supposedly were told that by other exiles that if you invade in 2003, you'll be received by flowers and chocolates. But these were the same Shiites in the south who had been betrayed just 10 years earlier, and they weren't necessarily ready with flowers and chocolates. They still hated Saddam, and they wanted to see him go.
But they were being pretty careful about how far having been betrayed once. Okay, charge number three. That the U.S. and the West did not prevent the use of chemical weapons against the Kurds in 1988. Maybe you should set the scene for what was going on at that point.
Well, this was during the 1980s. Saddam was in a war against Iran. He had gone to war against Iran in August of 1980, and after having been given a green light, if you will, by Jimmy Carter to attack Iran. Carter denies today that he gave any kind of permission or encouraged the Iraqis to attack, but there was a memo by Alexander Haig, who was Secretary of State to Reagan. Alexander Haig, after a trip through the Middle East a couple of years after the war had begun, wrote a letter to Reagan saying that he'd been told by the Saudis and Jordanian leaders that the U.S., Carter, via them, had given the red light to Saddam to attack Iran. And of course, that was a war that went on for 8 years and resulted in probably about 1 million dead on both sides. So anyways, the Saddam and the Iraqis were kind of de facto allies of the United States in that war. And Saddam began using poison gas against the Iranians in 1983. At that time, the Iranians protested. These are illegal weapons. But the United States blocked an attempt by the United Nations to investigate and to do anything about it.
Took almost a year before the West started to stomp on Iraq about using chemicals.
Well, they really didn't
they made
stomp
public
on
statements.
Them. They made a couple of statements, but warning, sort of apologizing to the Iraqis first about doing it. And so then in 1988, when Saddam was having problems with his own Kurds, they decided to use chemical weapons against them as well. And they felt they could get away with it because they'd really had no problem all along with the international community when they used chemical weapons. At the time, the United States was also giving intelligence aid to the Iraqis, Iraqis via satellite photographs, telling them how to target the Iranian troop formations. And when they found out around 1988, the same time as Saddam attacked his own Kurds, they found out that he was starting to use nerve gas on the battlefield. And I spoke to the DIA, the U.S. Intelligence agent who was serving in Baghdad at that time, giving the Iraqis the information they needed for targeting. And he said, we went out into the battlefield, and all of a sudden he found these kind of atropine injectors that are used to protect yourself against nerve gas. And he suddenly realized the Iraqis had graduated from mustard gas to nerve gas, which was a much more deadly...
Was it sarin?
Sarin and tabum, much more deadly substance.
What happened was the name of the town Halabja?
Halabja was the Kurdish town, yeah.
And what happened there?
The Iraqi planes flew over, and what had happened originally was that the Kurds had helped some of the Kurdish Peshmerga, their own militia, had helped the Iranians attack that town and had taken it over. This was while the war was still going on. So the Iraqis reacted by sending their planes to bomb the town, even though the Iranians had now pulled out. You only had Iraqis there now and Kurds, women and children and some of the fighters. And they went there and they dropped various kinds of chemical weapons, I think mustard and nerve gases, on the town, and approximately 5,000 people died. I mean, you saw the pictures. There were mothers lying frozen on the ground, holding their child still in their arms. These kinds of things. So anyways, these pictures got out, and it was quite a sensation in the press. But when they did, Reagan was still in power. They pretended they didn't know who had done it. They had to study it. They refused to condemn Saddam and the Iraqis for having done it. They held off for several months before they condemned them, and the chemical attacks continued against other Kurdish villages during that time. And the U.S. Congress, some of the congressmen were very upset about this, and they tried to pass a law to bring trade sanctions against Iraq and against Saddam and stop huge amount of foreign credits that the U.S. was giving to Saddam. And Reagan and then the Bush administrations battled that, managed to defeat that proposal in Congress so that the U.S. would continue to trade and support Saddam Hussein.
So you would argue that the West could have prevented the use of chemical weapons against the Kurds?
I think if they'd spoken up even back in 1983 and said, this is a no-go, and strongly let them know they weren't going to stand for it, I think they could have had an impact. I mean, no one will ever know. But what happened when this DIA agent discovered they were using nerve gas, that was just about the same time that Halabja happened. He contacted his superiors in Washington, and they said, this is a bad development. They pulled their agents out of Iraq, these intelligence agents, and they held a conference for about a week in Washington in which they discussed which it's worse. If we stopped helping Saddam Hussein, then Khomeini and Iran might win. And so they decided to continue helping Saddam Hussein, and he continued using his chemical weapons.
Okay. Like any good trial, you have to have a recess. So I want to take a recess from the trial part. Maybe you can have a sip of water if you need one. But it's also because I want to go just sideways for a little bit. And I think most of us remember in the lead up to the Second Gulf War, the French minister at the UN arguing against the invasion of Iraq, very eloquently presenting the great case against why an invasion was wrong. And it made us all feel very proud of the stand that the French were taking. But the French have been up to their elbows in Iraq for decades. Can you describe the role of the French in supporting that regime?
Oh, sure they had. They had been... in 1975, Saddam, he'd not even become formal. He was still just a power behind the throne in Iraq. He came to France, and Jacques Chirac was the prime minister, and Chirac sold him a nuclear reactor. And even though Saddam, on his way back to Iraq, stopped off in Beirut and gave an interview to a Beirut newspaper saying that he was planning to build nuclear weapons. And I mean, French scientists complained about it. Israel obviously complained about it. And the French acted as if they didn't know that Saddam really had evil intentions in mind. They were interested in sales. And the Mystère, they sold their most sophisticated jet fighters to Saddam.
And there may even have been French pilots helping.
During the war with Iran, I was told by one person that he had heard that there were French pilots piloting the French planes that were being used against the Iranian formations. The French also built an incredibly sophisticated ground radar system for Saddam, which when 1990 came around, and now the French were on the other side, part of the U.S. coalition, they had to help the coalition destroy that system that they had first given to the Iraqis. They gave them the specific coordinates to the radar sites so that they could be destroyed. Okay. The other thing that happened was that in 1990, when the first Gulf War took place, the French, again, were American allies supposedly at the time, but they were unable to fly their own sophisticated fighters because they were exact same fighters that they had sold to the Iraqis. So they were afraid that they'd have the same radar signature and they'd be shot down.
All right, let's deal with the last charge. Court's back in session, and I know that this going at your book this way makes us jump around in time, and it may seem a little bit disjointed. But now we go to 1980, and Iraq invading Iran, and as you've pointed out, that was a war that lasted probably 8 years, resulted in millions of deaths. How did the West encourage Saddam to go ahead and start that war?
Well, as I said, first of all, Jimmy Carter, via the Saudis, let Saddam know that, we're all for you. The Saudis told Saddam there'd be billions of dollars available to support him. So did the Kuwaitis. They were scared stiff of Khomeini because he was attacking them and their regimes, calling for the people to overthrow them. And they promised to control oil production so that that wouldn't be too troubled by an invasion of Iran. He knew that if he moved, he'd get full backing. Also, he thought it was going to be a very easy war. It was almost like George Bush this time around thinking it was going to be an easy war, and it turned out to be the Iraqis immediately ran into trouble. And the U.S. Many of the Western countries, but the U.S. over the next 8 years continued to supply Saddam with weapons and make sure that he got them, if not from them, then from others like the Egyptians. He got cluster bombs.
And the intelligence.
From the Chileans. That was courtesy of the CIA. No, they kept him well armed.
And they gave him information about where the Iranians were.
And they had the intelligence information that they provided as well. But towards the end of the war, in 1988, U.S. planes were actually flying missions, if you will, for the Iraqis. They destroyed some Iranian camps within Iran as part of their effort to police the Gulf. But in fact, they took an active role in fighting for the Iraq.
But they were also supporting Iran at exactly the same time.
About halfway through, they decided.
Why?
That was the Iran-Contra. That had to do with hostages that had been taken in Lebanon, American hostages that had been taken in Lebanon. And in Washington, they became very concerned about those hostages. And they figured that the Iranians could pull the strings in Lebanon, perhaps. And the way to get them to do that would be to offer them arms, even though you're arming the other side. So what they did was they encouraged Saddam to fly even deeper flights into Iranian territory to attack Iranian cities in order to put more pressure on the Iranians, so the Iranians would want to come to the United States to ask them for help, weapons.
So that then they would give the weapons.
So then they would give the weapons, and then in return the Iranians then would see about getting the hostages released in Lebanon.
Boy. What a tangled web you weave.
But you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who died during that war.
While all of this is going on.
And in fact, because of them giving these weapons, Israel and the United States, to Iran, the war went on much longer than it should have. And actually, the United States didn't want either side to win. So when it looked like the Iranians were doing too well, then they gave more support to the Iraqis. And when the Iraqis were doing too well, they gave more support to the Iranians. And Henry Kissinger at one point said, we just hope that the two sides kill each other. But it was like Henry Kissinger was talking as if it were the two leaders, but not the fact that, again, a million people died in that war.
There's one last question I want to ask about this particular section, particular period of Iraqi history, and it's a kind of a terrible irony, and there's much in this book that I haven't read in other places, and this is certainly one example of it. Iraqi troops were actually trained at Fort Bragg in the United States in resistance, and you suggest that perhaps some of the resistance that's being effectively used against
them. We don't know. They were trained. This was
now
at the time
might have
when,
come out of their own training at Fort Bragg.
Right. When they were allies, de facto allies in the 80s, some Iraqis of their special forces came to the United States and were trained with U.S. special forces in Fort Bragg. And the idea was that if the Iranians overran Iraq during that war, that these people could form the resistance against the Iranians.
And that might have happened.
Who knows?
Against the Americans.
Yeah.
Well, there's much we haven't covered, and we're going to open things up for questions from the floor. We have microphones, and I know it might be difficult for some people on the fringes to get to the microphones, but I would encourage you. It's going to be a minute, so don't start lining up yet. I would encourage you to use them because then everybody will be able to hear, and also we're making a recording of the event, and that will make sure that that everybody hears. So we haven't done much about the recent history in Iraq and the current situation, and I will ask you about that in a second. But one of the amazing things that I read, and I don't know whether these plans are still in place, but one of the amazing things in your book is that amidst the horror and misery that's going on in Iraq and Baghdad now, the U.S. is building an embassy compound.
Huge.
That sounds so surreal. It's impossible. Can you describe it?
Well, it apparently is the largest American embassy anywhere in the world. I think description said it covered an area larger than Vatican City. But it also
pools,
has
tennis courts,
everything. I mean, it's a ghetto, a huge American ghetto within the Green Zone. I mean, the Green Zone itself is this kind of artificial fortified bunker in the middle of Baghdad, and within that there is this new American embassy with shopping centers, McDonald's. So that Americans will be able to stay there and live and survive forever maybe. And the Iraq study group looking at the current embassy there right now, there are already 1,000 American diplomats in Baghdad within this Green Zone. 5 of them speak Arabic fluently.
And that's still, the plans are for this to be finished or something, 2007?
Yeah, but so that you've got that, plus you have at least 2 huge bases, really mammoth bases that are being built, one which is, I think they've spent about $500 million on so far. And Congress has passed the construction on the grounds that these are kind of temporary bases. But they're not. And any thought that the United States is really going to pull totally out of Iraq is just, those are dreams. They're going to stay there. And they see it it's got to be their major strategic location in that part of the world. Because they were worried that they couldn't stay in Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's one of the last questions I have for you, is on the point of strategic objectives. And I feel as though I'm somewhat inadequate to, if I am in fact acting in defense of the West in their actions in Iraq over the years, I'm not sure that I'm up to the task. But one observation I would make is that isn't the history of empires and powerful nations that they choose client states in strategic geopolitical areas of the world and use those client states as proxies to advance their interests? And if it means making some kind of accommodation with a tyrant, you do that as long as they're not too tyrannical, because you've got your interest to protect. And in doing that, the West, the United States, has not acted any differently than the Soviet Union did, that many nations have done over the course of the last century, finding a place where they can operate out of in order to advance their own interests. Is what the United States has done and the West has done in Iraq any different or any worse than that pattern of history?
Wow. I think you're talking about a totally different scale today, because I think the United States today has the greatest the greatest military power this planet has ever known. I mean, I'm listening now to the debate in Canada now, apparently, about spending $1 billion to buy 4 aircraft, transports. I mean, the United States is spending that probably every 2 days in Iraq. And the cost of their effort in Iraq, including compensation for all the wounded soldiers, etc., is estimated it will be about $2 trillion. I mean, I think it's a totally different order of things. I think the United States has been far more aggressive, if you will, as far as organizing coup d'etat, attacking other countries. They've got, hundreds of bases around the world, probably more aggressive as an imperial power than perhaps any country, in the history of this planet.
So this is my last question, and maybe you don't have anything to add to something that you said before, but I think the newspaper reports today talked about 85 people dying in Iraq yesterday, something like that, and clearly there is no end in sight. What do you see as the future in this situation? I mean, you talked as though you believe the Americans will be there for...
No, I think they want to keep their presence there. And I think even though if they pull, they may pull out, you know, they'll pull out, say, 100,000 troops or 120,000 troops, so they still want to keep those bases. I don't know. I mean, the Iraq study group said there is no good solution for Iraq today, and there isn't. I mean, Bush has gone in there and essentially destroyed a country. He's ripped it apart. There were three different peoples originally, but over the years there'd been a feeling that they were belonging to the same nation, a bit like the former Yugoslavia. But the U.S. going in there has kind of unstrung all that, has taken away any kind of glue that there might have been, so that neighbors, Shiites and Sunnis living as neighbors, are now regarding each other as enemies, you know, killing each other rather than be killed by them. And there's a level of fear and passion that I think the U.S. has provoked by its actions. And where it ends, I don't think anybody knows today. There's going to be thousands of more people are going to die. But hopefully they will come to a point, and they already are doing it, separating themselves into the Kurds, the Shiites, and the Sunnis. There's already ethnic cleansing going on. You know, hundreds of thousands of people are moving in that country even as we speak, and forming new population groups. So that's probably what's going to happen. And eventually, I think the idea of the Iraq study group, that you have to bring the Syria and the Saudis and the Iranians into a conference, because they don't want chaos in that part of the world either, I don't think. I mean, they're glad to see the United States having problems, but they don't want to be sucked into a conflict there themselves.
So the solution might have to be made on the ground there.
Oh, it'd have to be. Yeah.
All right.
And you are listening to broadcaster Hal Wake interview Barry Lando, author of Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush.
Good. Now, questions. So there were a couple of people were...
Hi. I was wondering, I know you mentioned that the main reason cited for the sanctions was for the populace to uprise against Saddam Hussein, I believe. It was cited a couple times. Do you think possibly the actual reason is to destroy the country, to weaken the populace so they have control over the resources and there's no threat of an unpredictable transfer of power? Say the Kurds took over, then you'd probably have a government that's totally unfriendly to American interests, and then they have a very important oil-exporting country that they don't have control over.
Yeah. I don't know. I think the theory originally was to force Saddam out of Kuwait. That didn't work, the sanctions. Then it was to force him to open up to weapons inspectors, and he did. But then the main underlying theme all along was, and the Americans made it clear. I mean, they would make statements about, well, Saddam has agreed to do this, and he's agreed to do that. But then Clinton finally said, yeah, but this isn't going to end until Saddam goes. And that was a signal, you know, to the people, do it. But there was no way that people could do it.
Yes, over here.
My question is a two-parter based on what you said a minute ago about Jimmy Carter giving the green light for Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. Before Saddam invaded Kuwait, there was a story that the U.S. Ambassador April Glaspie gave him the green light, and then, of course, George Bush the First said, no, that's wrong, and so we're going to respond. So I'm wondering, number one, did she get it wrong somehow to the U.S. ambassador, or was it a setup?
Well, she was made a scapegoat. She was only one of the American officials who said that the United States would take no action, didn't want to get involved in border disputes, as they called it, between Iraq and Kuwait.
Right.
In fact, just about 3 days before Saddam actually invaded, the Assistant Secretary of State appeared before Lee Hamilton in the Congress and was asked, John Kelly, and he was asked point blank by Hamilton, if Saddam invades Kuwait, do we have any treaty obligations to defend Kuwait? And he tried two or three times to avoid answering the question, but finally Hamilton pinned him down, and he finally said, no, we don't. We have no obligations to defend them. Well, I mean, the Iraqis heard this loud and clear. But even beyond that, George Bush Sr. wrote a letter to Saddam after this meeting with April Glaspie, in which he also, it was a very kind of mild letter, saying, we hope to get along better with you, but there was no one drew a line in the sand saying, you step over that line and, you know, we're going to be forced to take military action. If they had, Saddam, I'm sure, would never have invaded Kuwait.
Which brings me to the second question. What was the U.S. Motive for getting Saddam, to encouraging him to invade Kuwait?
They didn't encourage him to do it. I mean, they didn't, first of all, their eyes were on the Soviet Union, which was coming apart at the time, so that Bush and Baker, that's where their attention was. And you had kind of lower officials, you know, jumping up and down and saying, hey, you know, Saddam is moving thousands of troops towards Kuwait, but they were still off in worrying about the Soviet Union. And they simply didn't send a message to say, you know, don't cross this line. It wasn't that they wanted him to, but they didn't warn him what would happen if they did. On the other hand, they were playing another
game. And he read that signal to say that he could invade Kuwait and that they wouldn't react.
Yeah, he read it to say that, well, okay. Because he'd felt all along during the 80s that, you know, the U.S. was kind of, he was kind of their de facto ally in a way. And in fact, he wanted to be the new policeman of the Gulf, as the Shah had been. He wanted to be on good terms with the United States. But the Kuwait thing was even more cynical than that, in a way, because on the other side, all along, the United States had been encouraging Kuwait to use its oil production. By increasing its oil production, they lowered the world price of oil, and that put tremendous pressure on Iraq, which was just emerging from the war with Iran and needed its oil revenues. Well, the oil prices plummeted because Kuwait had caused them to, and Saddam was desperate. And he went to the Kuwaitis and said, you know, you've got to change your policies because you're destroying my country, you know, my government. And the Kuwaitis refused to back down. Now, why little Kuwait refused to back down when Saddam, with a million-man army, came to them and said, you know, change your policies? He was getting encouragement from the United States, the Kuwaitis were, not to negotiate with Saddam. So, I mean, they were playing both sides. And I think they were very much responsible, as certainly as much as Saddam, for what happened.
Thank you.
Yes, over here.
Okay, my question is that what the charges, if there's such a time that the people of the world could lay charges against Americans, would they say that is that they are committing the crime of fooling the people of the world that they are really there to uphold democracy.
Thank you.
No, I think some of the neoconservatives really would, you know, thought that by invading Iraq and knocking off Saddam Hussein that they might be able to establish a democratic, some kind of democracy in the Middle East. I mean, Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, was among them. But I don't think that was the main goal at all of the United States. There was no way, I think, if George Bush had said back in 2003, we're going to spend $2 trillion to bring democracy to Iraq, that the Americans would have supported that.
Yes, sir.
I'm a big fan of Greg Palast reporting. He's one of the only sort of remaining true journalists to me in that sense. He really gets to the heart of the issues. And one of his theories that his posits about why this canon, the USA, shifted attention from Afghanistan to Iraq after 2003, after 9/11, was because Saddam was yanking the price of oil up and down during the oil for food scandal, which was upsetting oil price markets, which was really the true pain in the side of the West and the Saudis and OPEC. So my question is, do you agree with that? And the second question is, Who do you think is the true power pushing Bush today? Is it AIPAC? Is it the neocons? Is it big oil? Because that, if we can answer that question, then we can almost guess what's going to come next.
I haven't heard the business about manipulating the oil. I don't think that Iraq's production at the time, I don't think, was large enough to have been able to do that. No, I think they wanted to get him for other reasons. I don't think, it's my own view, I don't think it was the oil thing. What is behind Bush today? You know, I think maybe those other groups that you're talking about were important earlier on as far as bringing about the invasion of Iraq. They may have played a role, but among a lot of other things too. But I think today it's just it's George Bush in a cocoon, and really totally isolated from reality. And I think it is one of the most frightening things probably that's happened in many years on this planet, is that you can have a small group like that, with the United States Congress being against it, and certainly the American people, and yet their leader can say, we don't care, as Dick Cheney said a few days ago, we don't care what you do, we're still going ahead, you know, or Bush saying, I'm the decider. I mean, it's frightening.
Yes, sir.
I guess my question is around the Sunni-Shia divide, if you would. To about 6 or 8 months ago, I've always heard the Iraqis say that they identify themselves as Iraqis first and not as Sunnis and not as Shias. And I'm just wondering what you think. There is a theory out there that this is actually created by the United States. And supporting that is the fact that a lot of the terror squads can be really tied to the Iraqi police themselves. And de facto, the United States controls the government, therefore they control the police. What do you think of that? What do you think of that theory?
Well, I mean, there's a certain degree of... I'm interested in one question that I think hasn't been answered. And I didn't put it in my book, but I wrote it on an article a while ago about it. Was back about 2 years ago, there was talk the United States was working with the Iraqi police, and they were organizing special squads of the Iraqi police. And they were supposed to deal with these the insurgents, and to work with these special squads, they brought some Americans who had previous experience in Central America, in El Salvador and Honduras, running death squads there. And there was a long article in the New York Times about this, and a couple of other newspapers. This is about a year and a half ago, and since then that whole subject has just kind of dropped from sight. But, I mean, it is an interesting question, is what happened to these people who were trained by the United States essentially to go out and liquidate leaders of the insurgents? What happened to those units? You know, are they still functioning today, and are they among those that are responsible for the killing that's going on?
I mean, I guess that's what the theory is that realistically, there is not much of a Sunni-Shia divide. It's sort of a paper.
No, but there is definitely a Sunni-Shiite divide as well. I mean, one that's becoming, you know, increasingly bitter and I mean, terrible. But before, as I was saying, you had gotten to the point under Saddam, not that it was to his nothing, not to take away from his the evil nature of the man, but you did have the point where Sunnis and Shiites were living in the same neighborhoods, where they were intermarrying. There were even some political parties that both Sunnis and Shiites belonged to. But by the process that began with the invasion, that's all unraveled. Again, a bit like the former Yugoslavia.
Okay, next question.
Thank you. We seem to be hitting on a lot of the issues that the media drops like a hot potato, and two that come to mind for me are during the Gulf War, at the end, the first Gulf War, when the Iraqi army was in complete disarray and fleeing back to Baghdad and abandoning their weapons. I understand that the American Air Force bombed the army on the road, and hundreds of thousands, or at least 100,000 soldiers died that day. My question number one is that not a war crime? And the second one is, before the Americans invaded Iraq in 2003, they had planned for a year and a half for this battle, and surely they had a game plan for protecting the antiquities, the riches of Iraq. And it seems that they protected all the oil interests, but nobody thought to put tanks around the museums.
Could well, they did. I mean, the State Department, there was a study group that was put together, for a year before the invasion took place. There were a number of study groups in the United States. NGOs came and talked. The State Department had, I don't know, hundreds of people working on all the things that the eventualities if there were an invasion. And one of those things was the question of protecting antiquities. I mean, people who knew what wealth Iraq had in that area.
How is it they all disappeared?
Well, they went to the government and said, we've got to do something about protecting these museums and so on. Finally, all these plans were ignored. The Pentagon took over control of the invasion of Iraq. And as you say, I mean, the only ministry that was protected after the invasion was the oil ministry. Mm. All the others were looted.
And the slaughter of the troops in retreat, is that not a...
The slaughter of the troops, there were some. It was nothing, as far as I know, it was nothing like 100,000. But it was enough to, when pictures hit the television, it was enough to make George Bush Sr. decide to stop the war early before he had really destroyed Saddam's forces, which was the whole object of the war. So that the whole exercise was really for nothing, because the majority of Saddam's troops, his best forces, managed to escape, and Saddam remained in power.
But is that a war crime?
Attacking, fleeing, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And I guess my main concern is why have the media chosen to ignore these important type
questions? The attack on the fleeing columns got, I mean, the reason we know about it is because it did get a lot of play in the media. What I find interesting today, though, is going back to the trial, is the fact that the trial is continuing. I mean, Saddam is no longer there, but the various charges are still continuing to be brought. And there's the one right now involving the Kurds is in full bloom. And in about 3 or 4 months from now, there's going to be a trial of about 100 former Iraqi officials who were responsible for the slaughter following the uprising of 1991. And this has been covered. I mean, the trial's covered in the American press, but there is not a word, and this is today, there's not a word about the complicity of the United States in with the Kurds, the gassing of Halabja. And this is in papers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, which are covering the trial. They're covering it as if it really was just the Iraqis. Mm. And that's what I find so surprising.
Our time is up. That concludes our presentation of broadcaster Hal Wake interviewing Barry Lando, author of Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush, published by Random House. This is part of the Talk of the Town series, presented by the Office of Community Affairs of the University of British Columbia on February 2, 2007. Find out more on the web at www.communityaffairs.ubc.ca/talkofthetown. We'd like to thank Barry Lando and Hal Wake for allowing us to share this program with Co-op Radio listeners. And you are listening to Co-op Radio CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, where we present the best speeches of Vancouver every Tuesday at 12 noon.